I think I started off the questioning with, Mom, do you believe that this man, this 900-year-old man, put two of every animal on this boat? Yes. Okay. Did he have help? Yes. He had sons and, you know, his family help. Okay, cool. Were there koalas on the boat? Yes. Why are you asking me about koalas? So I brought up, well, koalas can only eat eucalyptus, and eucalyptus only grows in Australia. So how did you get koalas from Australia to the Middle East?
So you may be wondering, who is this guy asking all these funny questions to his mom about Noah's Ark? And if you're a fan of the podcast, the voice may sound familiar to you because it is the inimitable Travis Green from Let Us Talk Books. Travis is an atheist with a collection of religious texts that's probably much bigger than yours. And in this episode, we talk about all things religion and how to have impossible conversations. Check it out. Our guest needs no intro, you know what I'm saying? It's our friend Travis Green. It's our homie. Had to bring him back on, chop it up about some more books. And
I appreciate y'all for having me back on.
Yes, totally. Yeah, tell us about the books that you chose for this morning, and a little bit about the first time you read them and why you like them.
So the two books that we're going to talk about today are some very, I would say, poignant books. Definitely in my work with talking to people and just having good discourse with other people and developing rapport. One book is called How to Have Impossible Conversations. So it's by a philosophy professor out at Portland State. So he teaches a template on how to actually have conversations with people that you technically don't agree with, which kind of segues me into one of the books that I've read some years back called God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, who back in the early 2000s was a less than premium guest for most people, because the new atheism, so to say, was on the rise after the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, the critique of religion was at the forefront. So he was one of the big proponents of that. But I paired those two books together because it's funny, because the last time we talked, I mentioned that I identify as atheist, and I've been identifying as atheist for at least the last, say, decade. And it's important to, I think, let the audience know that in America in general, you have the Black community as probably roughly, and don't quote me on this statistic, but I would say at least 80% Christian, with another like 10 to 20% Muslim. But that tiny minority of Black people that are actually identify as atheists, we need to be able to have conversations amongst each other, especially if we are living in America that has legislation getting pushed because of religious fundamentalism.
Yeah. Do you think using like the model of how to have impossible conversations, or since you've read the book, has there been a time where you think like, wow, you really had a thoughtful or reflective conversation about atheism with, you know, someone who believes in a religion or another atheist?
I don't think it's primarily the templates that I use. I don't primarily use it just in talks about beliefs or God beliefs. I honestly use it every day, no matter what the conversation comes to, because the tools and tips that he gives in the book are honestly things that just makes conversation better in life, right? One of the big tips is build rapport with your conversation partner, right? Everybody knows that sometimes you don't like talking to people who don't listen well. Who would love talking to somebody who doesn't listen well? That's one of those main tips in the book. Like, if you can't actively listen to your partner and respond to their point, why would you want to have an interesting conversation with them?
Right.
And it that goes throughout any topic that you're discussing, whether that be traveling, whether that be what you do for work every day. all these tips can help no matter what it is. But it's more important when the conversation topic turns to something that is highly contentious, such as religion, such as race, such as all these other hot topics that tend to get heated instead of just a basic conversation.
Yeah, it was funny for me because I read How to Have Impossible Conversations first. And then as I was reading God Is Not Great, I'm like, why am I getting frustrated? It's because this is not a conversation. And like, because I feel like, right, Hitchens is delivering his truth, delivering his message, which is one of their rules to not do. And right, because I could never respond back. And Hitchens is just like such a witty and funny writer. He's always trying to make jokes. It's just like, man, like it seemed like he was going, you know, for the kill shot. Like it didn't even seem like Hitchens has this shared goal of like, oh, let's both seek truth. He really wants to argue like, oh yeah, like this poisons everything. And like, there's no questioning it. And yeah, I will say it's a well-argued book. And there are a lot of examples that, you know, of course, any rational being would think are just ludicrous, right? Yeah, I think part of it though too is like, he always, to me, like, because he's such a funny, witty speaker and writer, like his arguments can seem like a bit of like sophistry, just like, you know, kind of that magical, I'm convincing you really through like my wording and my turn of a phrase and not like my actual arguments. But right, he's a brilliant guy. I'll start there.
Yeah, it's funny that I kind of linked those two books together because pretty much all of the tips that Dr. Boghossian gives are things that kind of contrast with Hitchens' style. So if you've read his work outside of God Is Not Great, so he has some other books, Why Orwell Matters, Hitch 22, but he most came to prominence in his debate lectures.
Right.
And debate and formal debate is not a method to get to understanding. It's honestly just to lay out your points, make an argument without reasoning with your conversation partner. And in our discourse now, I feel, and I would like y'all's input on this, that we kind of debate with each other way too often instead of truly trying to get to understand why a person thinks the way they think. Right. Now, there is a nuanced part to that is, hey, can you sit down and talk with somebody who has a viewpoint that's diametrically opposed to yours? So, for example, can you sit down and talk to somebody that doesn't believe Black people are equal to white people? I mean, you should be able to. Daryl Davis, the musician that has converted plenty of KKK members, has. And it seems quite impossible to do something like that, but we see that it can occur, right? The same can be said for religion. Like, I'm an atheist. Like we talked about on the last episode, y'all are spiritual, but we're sitting here talking and being civil towards each other, no matter if we have a belief that is different from each other. But that's kind of the goal, is to let's stop debating each other and actually talk with each other again.
No, that's facts. I feel like, especially online discourse, which I feel unfortunately is where a lot of this is taking place, it's not only that people are debating all the time, it's that they're debating with like everyone at all times. And like, they don't really even know whose point it is or who they're specifically debating. They're just debating with large groups like QAnon or like anti-vaxxers or anybody. And they're just like, y'all are stupid for this, and this reason. But right, there's no face-to-face interaction. It's devoid of like any empathy, any understanding. It's just like, here's my point. I'm absolutely right. And right, it's sad, but I think it really gets folks in a echo chamber that are just damaging to any kind of learning. So
I was going to say that I've noticed too how popular the like debate videos are on YouTube specifically, right? Where you see like the Jordan Peterson shuts down like liberal college students, you know, for like for 20 minutes. It's just a compilation of him like destroying people. You know, he's not the only person. He's just like, he's a very popular one because like Hitchens, he is incredibly smart and knows how to debate well, which is a very particular type of talking. It's not, I don't see it as conversation. But, you know, I actually think of another book called Metaphors We Live By, which describes how you can think of conversations as war, or you can think of it as dance, right? And so like the debate kind of practice is more around fighting and like winning a side, which, you know, as How to Have Impossible Conversations talks about, is that like you can win, but you know, if you're thinking of this as a long-term relationship with somebody, you're losing in the long run because you still have to deal with them thinking you're an asshole, right? So that I think seeing that, having that shift from reading that book into thinking of conversations as dances has definitely enabled me to have more fun and see them as light and ways of like learning and understanding. But it's pretty clear that YouTube does not seem to like work that way. Just off of not only how echo chambers work, but also what's, you know, what people are interested in seeing. Maybe it has something to do with just the whole notion of like clickbait, you know, like what's that thing that really kind of like triggers you to want to watch something. But I think that it also is obviously a reflection of just where we're at socially and politically when people aren't talking to each other. And it's like with every new event, people are just kind of entrenched in whatever it is that they already believed, you know?
Yeah, I think you brought up two great points is like, hey, one, conversation should be a partnership, right? Like I'm in this conversation with you. Mm-hmm. And we should both mutually leave the conversation feeling well. Like, mm-hmm. I think that dance metaphor is perfect for that, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're sitting down here talking and we all three left our previous conversation feeling good, uplifted. We should charged be. Up. Yeah, we were charged up. Like we're ready to execute the day, right?
Right.
But this normal conversation tactic through YouTube, social media, that was your second point, Jan, was like you look for the kill shot because it's you're more able to, I guess, get followers massively through Discord and negativity instead of, all right, let's watch somebody have good conversations.
Wow.
And I think that has made our society just a little bit more tense because we can't talk to people who we disagree with without leaving it feeling like we had a civil conversation that got somewhere that had a good outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's worse too is like, because so many people believe that like, oh, right, if you're an atheist, or, you know, oh, if you believe in God, then like that means that you also have all these other character traits. So it's like not even worth talking to you because, you know, you're a Republican. And that also means, you know, you're, you know, anti-abortion, all this, you know, folks will just like create their own invisible laundry list of traits and attach it to the person before they even open their mouth. And that's what makes it even harder to like sit and have a conversation with someone. Cause again, they're assuming so much about like who you even are. And I feel like I've noticed that a lot with some of my peers who like are just unwilling to talk to any conservative person at all.
Yeah, and that's sad, right? Is I guarantee, guys, that even though we are much alike. We probably have a litany of topics that we just disagree on, like diametrically, right? I go through it every day in my normal life. This, I don't think this will come as a shock to people, but the bulk of the military or people in the military are usually lean conservative, or usually lean to the Republican side of issues, right? And for the most part, I don't have issues working with people who I disagree with. But for some odd reason, this, the thing that you're talking about, Miles, was like, why can't you have a conversation with somebody who you disagree with? Because one, fundamentally, you should be able to understand how they think and why they think that way, right? That's one of the principles and the fundamentals in the book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, is understand why your partner thinks the way they think and how they got to that conclusion. But you can't get there if you don't talk to anybody.
Yeah. And, you know, too, Travis, you just reminded me that there's a, there's some study or research that I saw that was saying that people live nearby, like people that have the same political beliefs as them, right? I mean, even if you look at, even if you look at voting maps, right, it's like pretty clear that people cluster together based off of their political beliefs. And so it's like, it's like, how long are people going without even actually knowing somebody that disagrees with them politically, right? I mean, that's a lot of time to kind of to pay attention to them as the other or the villain. So then once a specific person enters your life that you kind of encounter, let's say in college, who has a different belief as you, it's like you already have so much baggage coming in with these associations that Miles is talking about. But a huge part of that is like that we literally don't even live near people that have views that disagree with ours, unless you're, you know, in the military or in some other like incredibly diverse like workplace, right, where there are lots of different people.
That's an interesting point, Jan. So I kind of have like a two-tier question for the both of y'all. One is, how have y'all found a way or a method to get to talk to people who might not think the same way that you think? And then secondly, when was the last time, or if it has occurred or if it hasn't occurred, when was the last time y'all have actually talked to somebody who on the face of it seems like somebody that you would totally disagree with on a bunch of topics?
See, the thing is, I'm, you might be asking the wrong people just because Jen and I are generally like very open and open. So like our openness rating on, you know, whatever the openness scale is probably very high, just because like whenever we see anybody talk to anybody, we allow them to kind of, again, like color in our beliefs about them, and we're very forgiving. So yeah, I don't remember a time where I assumed someone was gonna have a lot of things I disagreed with. I'm trying to think. Oh, well, this is a time where I guess I was a bit uncomfortable and I didn't know what to do or say, but I kind of let it go. And I guess, so I was in England and we went to see Stonehenge, and our tour guide was this older white guy. And he was pretty funny guy. And as we're going around the monument, which is honestly much smaller than you would think in person, it's kind of underwhelming. He was like, at the end of the day, like, whenever someone starts talking about race, I just tell them we're all from Africa and we're all African. And I'm just like, what? Like, I didn't even know what to say, but it just caught me so off guard. Cause right, he's supposed to be telling us about all the theories and science of like why these rocks are aligned the way that they are. And he's like going on this weird tangent about race and like why we're all connected. And it's honestly, at the core of it, is beautiful, but also seemed so callous, and of course, Rome moved from like any deeper analysis of race going on at the time. And it's not right as an older white guy. Like, you can't just absolve that argument completely by saying that, you know, deep down the line, you know, your primordial grandmother's African. It doesn't like save you from any knowledge about race, right? So, right. I mean, and that wasn't even time, because I didn't get in an argument, but a time where I guess I regret not intervening more. And I wish I would have tried to even learn like how to do that, especially in a scenario that wasn't divisive and wasn't that bad, but we just kind of all let it go. Like, oh, he's just being, you know, a crazy old guy, basically. But that's the first one that comes to mind. Definitely. Because right, I do the assuming kind of after the fact too. I use it as a way to rationalize why he said that point, and rationalize a way to not intervene. So you know, it's like, oh yep, makes sense. I should have thought of that before you even open your mouth to say that, because you look like this. So I feel like, you know, that's kind of my bad too.
Oh man, that's interesting.
Yeah,
Jan, have you had something like that?
No, not really. I mean, actually, no, I probably have. Nothing's coming to mind right now. But to your first question, I think I was thinking about how sports have been so like important for us being able to be around people that we might disagree with and have conversations with lots of different people. Mm-hmm. I mean, me in particular, I played a lot of sports through high school, and that was critical to my sense of like open-mindedness, as well as just having like a really deep love of music, right? Because even before I had, you know, Spanish-speaking friends, I was listening to Spanish music, or just my curiosity to listen to like music from around the world generally, I think kind of was an early practice in getting to know other cultures that, you know, I had no clue about, as well as you know, beliefs that were totally different than mine. That goes for, you know, what we've talked about before, just with my upbringing around like learning about different religions. And so I would say that reading has always been kind of like another one of those practices that kind of helps with being open-minded, because, you know, I mean, Miles especially, he knows it better than I do, I think, because he was reading books by like Tucker Carlson,
and, oh man,
you know, like, yeah, just really getting deep into the sauce of, you know, Republican political theories and whatnot, and just that entire worldview. And I think through his example, I could see how books were such a low stakes and like safe way of encountering people that have other beliefs than you. And, you know, being in a conversation with them, even though, you know, Miles was just saying how, you know, people are often the messenger telling their message, you're not really having a conversation with them. You kind of are at the same time, just through like taking notes, writing in the margins, responding in a particular way off of things that they're saying. So I think that we have had a lot of practice in that, but we're also like particularly blessed, I would say too, just because, like, you know, as the people that we are, especially in the schools that we were in, it was relatively easy for us to like not see other people as totally threatening, you know, I'm sure that if I, you know, was more insecure, vulnerable related to like my citizenship status, as a lot of people, like, I would have very good reason not to, you know, want to feel comfortable interacting with like conservative politicians or conservative people, right? So I feel particularly like privileged in that way, just that given like how we grew up, who we are, we're kind of able to feel more comfortable around people. And so I don't know if that's like a fully good thing either. You know, it's kind of like a give and take, but
I mean, I think it,
it is about just recognizing, like, you know, who we are and our limitations, right? That we're not everybody. A lot of people have really good reasons to not, you know, want to have impossible conversations with people because their lives are at stake.
Yeah, I think those are a lot of great points that y'all bring up. Is it one? I'll speak to that last point you just made a little bit. It's like most people, and I know I'm generalizing, but I would say most people don't want to have impossible conversations because it is kind of earth shattering to encounter somebody with a belief that's different than yours. And then they could provide you evidence and information that contradicts your point of view. It's pretty earth shattering, right? Something as small as, you know, hey, your outfit doesn't look good today and you thought you just had on the freshest thing ever, right? That has an impact on you. So just imagine how impactful something would be if somebody were to present you evidence of something that's core to your belief structure, i.e. something like your Christian faith, right? I encounter people all the time that are fundamentally Christian. And when I tell them all of the baggage that goes with it, you can see that it's palpably hurtful for them to reconsider something that they truly believe. But that's one step you have to have, is to be open, like y'all two are, to have those conversations with other people, right? I'll just give you an example. So at work, I have this one individual that I talk to all the time. He's a great guy, a little bit older than I am. He's 44. But one of his things is he's real hardcore conservative, and I would say libertarian. So for the audience who might not know, like, the baggage to that term, libertarian is kind of a political philosophy that just says, hey, I want to be by myself. Government shouldn't tell me I don't have to do anything. They pretty much don't want streetlights because the government is telling them they have to stop. Yeah. Like, that's pretty much what it is, right? I'm kind of downplaying and minimizing, but you can get the gist of where I was going. So we actually got into a topic about what the role of government is for the people that live in that society, right? And the first thing that I always have to do with this individual is define the term that we're actually using. And that's one of the tips in the book, is define what you're actually talking about. So when he said he hates government, I had to define, what does he mean by government? Because government is this large nebulous term that, like, means completely different things to other people, right? So for me, government in my estimation meant good roads, local small government, fire departments, your local community government. But in his eyes, government meant bureaucracy, large federal oversight, you know, the deep state, quote unquote. So our conversation kind of evolved after we defined our terms. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, one of the questions I asked him, and I would suggest everybody does this, is completely just start with asking questions. Actually find out how somebody thinks first. Is one, I had to define the terms. What does he mean by government? Two, play on and listen to what your conversation partner is saying. So after he defined what he meant by government, I asked, would you like to take away the police departments? And his response was, no, that's the type of government I like. So I had to respond. well, you don't hate government. You like that portion of government. So can we iron out which government you hate and which government you actually like? That way we can narrow down and define what you actually mean by the statement you hate government. And I think we could do that with everything, right?
Wow. Wow. I can already visualize the tears rolling down this man's face. Just pure joy. Just like, oh man, Charles, help me see the light. Oh my gosh. No, that's so true. No, right. Cause like people, I mean, honestly, that's what I felt even with God is not great a little bit. Because when he says the simplest and most devastating critique of religion is that it's man-made, to me, like in that government case, like it almost feels like a misattribution of religion to human beings in general. So take this example, right? I think the two-party system is really bad here in America. I think it gets people thinking that, you know, these two choices are radically different. I don't think that they are. Different outcomes. I think that they're both very, very hypocritical. Have a lot of money going through them, corrupt, all this, right? Would I blame the consequences of the two parties on the party platforms? No, on the doctrine of the parties, no. I think it's more about the irresponsibility of like human groups in general, right? And in that way, I would even say like political parties act in similar ways to religion. Like if I were to ask Chris for Hitchens to write this same book with like 1,000 other people, you can't do it. Because groups are not meant to be rational like individuals are, right? And him like arguing that human groups over time under the name of religion have done crazy, crazy things, like to me, yeah, it makes sense, but it's not like religion is just one way that humans have like, again, made meaning out of forming groups. It's like the primary way. I don't think it will be the primary way going forward at all. And like this same, but I do think there's the same level of violence and craziness that he depicts will like of course persist because we're just humans, right? And the attribution will be to the internet, will be to political parties, but those are both other ways that like human beings show their irrationality through large groups. But yeah, that's I don't know if you have any response to that, Travis, but that was one of the confusions that I had.
So I do, it's funny because I have a profound respect for the way that Christopher Hitchens is unabashedly himself. I definitely have a great deep respect for that. His oratorical skills, his Same. Ability to write, I have a deep, profound respect for. Do I fall in the camp of, do I believe in, let me rephrase, do I lack belief in God that's similar to what he does? Yes, I don't believe that God exists, and I don't believe there's supernatural anything. I don't believe in fairies, tooth fairies, Santa Claus either, right? Mm-hmm. Where I disagree with him, and I found myself disagreeing with him a little bit more on just the religious aspect, is I have started to come into the camp that believes that religion was a force to take human individuals, like you were saying, yep. put them in large groups and get them rallied behind something similar and around something together to form a cohesive society. Right. Because to me, what would be the best way to get a large group of people who cannot agree on anything to come together and finally work together?
Yeah.
It's probably something sacred, right? A ritual, a thing that, you know, they all have to strive for a goal, right? In the ancient world, the best way to do that was through ancestor worship. Rallying behind a holy text. So I see religion in that context as something necessary for human societies and civilizations to evolve. What I think was profound in what you said, Miles, is now that, to me, religion has been replaced because of like the less than reputable claims, like, i.e. the earth was made 6,000 years ago, Muhammad rode to heaven on a winged horse, all those claims. I think human society needs something to replace it with. Like, we can't not replace it. Like, if my goal succeeds, right. And I want to take the religious fundamentalism out of our society, I have to replace it with something to give people hope. Yep. But I think that's a portion of the atheist community that I'm still trying to forward and make sure that we understand that, like, if you're going to take this portion, right, mm-hmm. we have to give people something back for that, right? One organization that I always talk about is Recovering from Religion. So there's these great people that have a bunch of secular therapists that after somebody comes out of a religion, they need that community, because that's what, at least in the South, that's what Black people had as a community, was their local church, mosque, mm-hmm. or whatnot. Like, if you wanted togetherness, you went there on a Bible study night, or you went to a Sunday morning. That was the best way to get together and meet people, have a big dinner on Sunday, was to go to a prayer meeting, right? The same thing in most portions of the world is you revolve around something that's sacred. But if you're going to take that away, you're going to take the supernatural element away, the obvious incorrect things away, you have to replace the community aspect. People need community. But the only way we can do that, we got to have a conversation with people about what we can do to help society move forward.
Yeah. You know, Travis, you're really speaking to this idea of, like, you know, basic human needs that I've been reflecting on a lot. I mean, even from how you're describing the evolution of religion and its importance, a necessity, right? Just for organizing people, or even what you're saying just now about community and having that fulfilled, even that sense of hope. I mean, I'm really curious to get your thoughts on this book. Maybe you've heard of it, Nonviolent Communication by Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. Have you read this before?
No, not yet. I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, see, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Maybe that'll be like our part three. Just because he emphasizes the importance of, you know, understanding that people have like universal human needs, right? Mm-hmm. And everything that we do is a part of, is in the spirit of trying to meet those needs. And he says that, like, we're trying to meet those needs, and it's regardless of whether or not we're actually accomplishing them, but recognizing that, you know, people are kind of like well-intentioned in that sense has just been really important for his work. But what was really interesting about him was that he was a communication expert from like family dynamics around, like, you know, helping couples who've been together 30 years finally start to connect, getting over like child parent beef. He was working on like family level stuff. He was working on school level stuff between like students and faculty and between faculty. And then he was doing some of the like Israeli-Palestinian conflict type mediations. Like he runs the full course of scales from individual families to international conflict, and really does a great job of like describing how the way that we talk about things with people is like very important, right? And the assumptions that we bring into that. And you just reminded me of him, just the way that you were describing things just now.
Wow, that's admirable, because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I know.
Oh man.
Yeah, I know. That's another combo.
That's a completely different combo.
No, oh, you man. would really love that book, though, Travis. It definitely, right, it builds on so many of the layers of, you know, how to have impossible conversations. But it's like more about not just having like these really well thought out debates. It's like, just how do you talk to people in like your everyday life in general? And just as you were saying at the start of building rapport. That's a thing you have to do with every single person. That is a thing you have to do with every single person. The nonviolent communication too. Like, it was so funny reading it for the first time, because like he changed the wording of like certain sentences, and you could like feel the difference like already, because I could remember times where I had said things in just the wrong wording, and it came off as like passive aggressive, mean, angry, all these things. You change around a couple of words and it feels way better, even like saying it, even hearing it in like your mind. It's crazy. So you would love that book. You gotta check it out.
Oh man, that's interesting. No, I gotta put it in my cart. Make sure y'all suggest a new black book for sure.
No, yeah. I was thinking though too, you know, tragically in the last week, the thing that's been on my mind a lot is the Travis Scott concert at Astroworld. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard much about it, Travis, but right to me, and it was really just this conversation that made me think of it. That almost feels like its own level of like religious fanaticism, like to be so engrossed in a celebrity, in an artist, you know, to be like pummeling the stage in that way just seems, I'm almost even more scared of seeing other human beings as deified than like Hitchens, you know, folks seeing God as deified, a non-earthly being. Because right when you get into that human component of deifying folks, I feel like it just gets into it's a tough line, because of course he lays out plenty of examples where folks are just as violent, but I think you see what I'm saying. Like even the way folks talk about the president every 4 years, like he might as well be God. Like the way folks think of him as being able to grant every single wish as if he was a Santa Claus or a tooth fairy too. It's like the president doesn't have this kind of supreme power that folks think that they will have when they vote them in. And I just see that my mindset is more prevalent than you would even think outside of religion.
Yeah, that is an important point, Miles. Yeah. And I really want to expand on that, because the deification process is probably, I think, one of the central themes in God Is Not Great is in order for you to make good people do evil things, you need to give them something outside of the human element, right? For example, in order to make a mob of people rush the Capitol on January 6th, you needed a central figure telling them that it is okay and the American government was going to make sure that they're okay, right? That's how you get a January 6th. Even on the other political side of the spectrum, if you have a deified figure of the Obamas, and in order to lull Black people to sleep and make them believe that everything is okay, you have this grand figure who is going to end racial strife in America. And we see that that's not the case. But in the essence of what Christopher Hitchens is talking about is the same thing, but he uses it to say it about religion in general, right? This is a contentious point, but what made a group of individuals fly two planes into the World Trade Centers, or the two towers of the World Trade Centers? Deification, religion, making something outside of themselves say that by this authority, I have the ability to commit violence on you. The same thing is said for religious fundamentalism in America, where you have people bombing abortion clinics, or you have fringe groups protesting outside of soldier funerals, abortion like advocates or anti-abortion advocates, all these things. You need something outside. You need a deified person to say, all right, well, my God told me that I can commit atrocities on you. And I think that's why we need to have impossible conversations, because we need to get to the basis of why people believe the things that they believe. And if we can get to that point, then we can possibly stop the violence that can occur, right? If we could have gotten to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden before 9/11 happened, would we have the second and third order effects of thousands of American lives lost in Iraq and Afghanistan, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives lost, hundreds of thousands of Afghan lives lost? Would we have gotten to that point if we could have talked to those individuals in a more meaningful way? I mean, maybe it's a too optimistic goal, but on the smaller level, can we stop the eventual people from doing harm in our local communities if we sit down and talk with them? And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why I want to express how to have impossible conversations to other people is maybe we can stop the low-level things around our community and honestly have better conversations with other people that we don't agree with. Mm.
No, that's a great point too. I think this is another difficulty that I had with Hitchens, though, is because he's talking about these major geopolitical issues, I also don't think that you can remove certain events from any other cause and effect of geopolitics. So with 9/11, right? Honestly, I won't be ashamed to say it either. Like a TV show totally changed the way I thought of 9/11. This show called Rami, right? And in the show, it's about him growing up as a Muslim in a post 9/11 America. And there's an episode where he has a flashback back to the day it happened. And as a kid, he's having this nightmare where he sees like Osama bin Laden in his house. And he like talks to him for like 5, 10 minutes, right? And he asks him like why he did what he did. Why did he do this 9/11 attack? And right, it is fake, but he goes into this whole explanation that like America basically right took away their autonomy and their economy and their ability to even make strawberries.
So the first part was right. The idea was that the autonomy, the sovereignty was taken away so that Americans could have strawberries in the winter, because he was trying to make the point that that off of, you know, like foreign aid, US interventions in the Middle East towards, you know, changing up their agriculture to support export crops like strawberries, it took away people's ability to actually like do subsistence farming, to actually, you know, live and survive on their own without, you know, help of some federal or international governments. And that's what Miles is trying to say.
Do I believe that if Marshall Rosenberg or Peter Boghossian, you know, went over and talked to Al-Qaeda, like, we would all be saved? Like, I don't know. Like, I think it's a matter of greater like decades long causes and effects that led up to it. Like, was it purely about belief in that sense? No. Like, were the direct actors that did those atrocities like that day, were they fanatics? Like, yes, right? But is the fanaticism like the root cause? Like, I would say Hitchens just doesn't delve into that, because right as he's writing this book, he's like defending America's choice to like invade Iraq and to get rid of, you know, Muslim fundamentalists by any means, right? So he has like an agenda at this time to like defend that point of view.
I mean, the other thing too, though, is, I mean, you just said it with stretching back decades, right? I mean, you stretch back centuries and you got the Crusades, right? Like, this isn't the first time And this definitely isn't the beginning of some like West versus East or the Middle East kind of war dynamic, which was also deeply shaped by religion. And obviously it's not the only thing, as Miles is saying, but yeah, I guess it just goes to show how so much of this is passed down and kind of like overlapping. And yeah, I mean, the cause and effect isn't incredibly clear, but religion is definitely like an agent in bringing about things as it has.
Yeah, and I think it gives us a great opportunity to understand people and why they think the way that they do. And I agree with you, Miles. So Christopher Hitchens had, there were some things that I wholeheartedly disagree with him with, right? His view on the invasion of Iraq was abhorrent to me. I don't think the United States should have ever had any intervention in Iraq. That's just my personal opinion. But I think the larger point, if we go back to kind of like the context, is can we just talk one-on-one to people about why they believe what they believe, and do they have reasons for believing what they believe? I'll illustrate it as an example. So I typically come across people, and this is not going to shock anybody, I typically come across a lot of Christians in my day-to-day life, right? I live in the southeast of America, and for the most part, you ride around, you see thousands of churches all over the place. You see billboard signs that say "Find Jesus now," and you typically see the street preacher with, and don't mean to offend anybody, but you see the street preachers with signs like "Gays go to hell," yada yada yada, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't, like, it's funny because I know my wife, every time we walk past one of those, she like has to like grab my arm and like keep me from talking to them. But like, if you don't stop and talk to them, then how will you ever get to know why they believe the way they believe, right? Because homophobia in America was, I believe that it was exacerbated by religious fervor.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
So I could point to something like that and say, okay, all right, why do you believe that homosexuals do not deserve the same rights as you? And if you don't talk to them, how will you know what their reasoning is for that and why they come to that conclusion? Mm-hmm. So the example is, hey, I was walking downtown. I saw a street preacher with a sign that said all gays go to hell, had a Bible verse on it. I stopped and talked with them for no more than 10, 15 minutes. And I got to the root just by asking, how did you come to your conclusions? How do you know that that is correct? If you were presented with some evidence, would it change your mind? And we came to an honest realization in just this particular instance that he believes the Bible is 100% true. When the Bible says gays are an abomination, he believes it. And he doesn't believe that God ordained a man to sleep with a man or a woman to sleep with a woman. But if I didn't actually talk to him and just wrote him off as some fringe person, then how would I ever know, like, hey, where can we meet in the middle? Where can we talk about this? Because that person votes. Like, it doesn't seem like it could affect your life, but people's actions and beliefs affect their act, or excuse me, people's beliefs affect their actions. So if this person believes that, they're more likely to vote against equality in marriage. They're more likely to vote against abortion access, like those things. So if you want a more just and complete society, we have to be able to talk with people we disagree with.
And I think that's such a beautiful example too. And it made me think of that story from the book where they were talking about, what was it? It was like some post-World War II study where they got a bunch of like housewives in like a room and they're like, oh, you all should cook this kind of meat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they were saying like it's always better to, instead of lecturing someone, try and get them to believe it on their own. And I think that's what you did so well with that example, is like, because you just kind of like tried to be curious and tried to step through their beliefs, like it probably allowed them the frame, like their own framework to like interrogating why they believe that stuff on their own, right? Because like they really would change when they're like, like that question that Travis asked, like that is like in the back of my mind, like a little, why do I think that for this reason? Because even saying that, right? But I think in a lot of arguments, because folks will try and drive their point so much, it cuts off the possibility of people even wanting to learn after the fact. I think that's the most important thing, because if folks want to come into the beliefs by themselves, giving folks the space to do that is like imperative, and knowing that you're not trying to convince them like in the debate, but you're just trying to like really like plant a seed of curiosity, like that is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's a great point, because yeah. I approach every conversation I have with somebody like that from a place of genuine curiosity. I literally just want to learn. I'm not here to give you a message. I'm not here to like speak facts to you. I just want to really learn why you think the way you think. I mean, that goes to the rapport piece in the book. That goes to actually getting to know somebody. That goes to a lot of things, right? But I think an obstacle, and let me know if y'all think the same way or feel the same way. An obstacle to a lot of this conversation that we have in our society now is like this polite political correctness that you're not supposed to speak about certain topics, right? Mm-hmm. I get all the time, like, Travis, why are you talking to somebody about their religion? You're not supposed to talk about that. Or Travis, why are you talking to somebody about their political beliefs or what they think about this? You're not supposed to talk about that. And I'm always like, why can't we?
Yeah.
We're both consenting adults. Why can't we?
Yep. I think, and what's funny about it, I found that at the end of the day, the conversations that are most stigmatized end up being the most fulfilling, because you don't have them very often. Like, if we talked about religion as much as we talked about the weather, like, I would not be grateful for it, right? But like, because it is in those rare cases, like with you, where it's like we're intentional about it and we want to talk about it because it is rare and because it gets to like the core of like a lot of like meaning of our lives, like it's important. Like, this is going back to the basic human needs thing that Jen was saying. We can't not talk about things that are like, again, very important to our lives and being, and that includes money, religion, identity, all that. Like everything is always on the table for me and probably you.
You talking about me?
Oh, Travis.
I really wanted to get your opinion on it too.
Because, well, I mean, yeah, no, I remember. I remember when I first got into high school. I had a coach who jokingly like said that, you know, the three things you're not supposed to talk about are religion, politics, and sports. And I was like, yeah, I mean, like, those are like low key my favorite things to talk about, you know. Like, but you know, luckily he wasn't bringing that up in a way to like chastise me. I think he was just pointing out the culture that we're in, which is very like avoidant of like topics that can lead to like, you know, fights, and you know, particularly fights among like family members. I mean, I'm not, we're not white, but I mean, you know, coming back from college break sometimes and people being like, oh, like there's nothing worse than like Thanksgiving dinner, having to get into a screaming match with my aunt and my uncle who are like Trump supporters, you know, like that's real shit. That's real shit, you know, but like, but I think that, you know, prayers out to all people dealing with that kind of stuff. But, you know, even within our own family, like we don't all agree on religion in the same way. And I think because it hurts so much to feel connected to somebody, but then also like not seen by them or not heard by them or be able to like hear them and their own perspective on something as crucial as like, you know, your core beliefs and whatnot. It's just really painful. And I think it's for a lot of people, for me, a lot of times it's easier to kind of like avoid the pain of it than like really embrace it. But you know, I actually just started this book called My Grandmother's Hands. It's beautiful. I read like the first 40 pages last night, and you know, he's talking about how trauma is actually in the body. It's not a intellectual or emotional thing. It's very much embodied. And you know, in particular, there are two types of pain that he like outlined. One is like clean pain, which is about like, you know, recognizing that pain is crucial to growth. And then dirty pain, which is kind of like the pain that you feel by avoiding that growth and that pain, obviously. And so it's like either way, you're going to feel pain, but at least in one, there's like at least one of them is the path towards healing and, you know, being able to have healthier relationships with the people around you. So I guess I kind of regard conversations around like religion, politics, sports, those kinds of things as like that clean pain that we can embrace, right? Yeah. It's definitely uncomfortable, but it goes a long way towards building those like deeper connections, right? And yeah, I mean, I guess that's part of what's so important about like stuff like this, right? Is that the opportunities are always around us every day. And it's really easy to just continue avoiding them, especially when, you know, you got shit to do, bills to pay, whatnot. But kind of to Miles's point, right? That's what makes it even more special when you do take the opportunity, or it's kind of like put on you and, you know, you can't avoid it, right? Just because of how it can really enable you to grow, even in understanding yourself and another person.
Yeah, man, I think that's amazing. It's beautiful, to be honest with you, because when you said the Thanksgiving conversations, all I'm reminded of is like, so I've had an impossible conversation lately. So I had this conversation with my mom. So let me just kind of set the scene for y'all. So my mom is a biblical fundamentalist, Southern Baptist, beautiful Black woman, right? For those who don't know, my mom believes everything in the Bible is completely 100% true, from 6 days to create the earth, from Moses getting tablets three times on a hill that nobody knows where it's at. Like, it's all completely true, right? So I honestly think it pains her to know that her son doesn't believe that it's true, but I could see it. It palpably pains her. But there was one conversation where I just had to have it, right? Because we generally, when we get together, especially when I take my kids to go visit her, we genuinely try to stay away from the topic because I know it hurts her. But I have to have the conversation because she's my kid's grandmother, right? Because there's ideas that I would like for my kids to have more nuance and context if she says things around them. One was the discussion about whether the global flood in the story of Noah was true. So geological data just proves that never occurred, right? If you want to say that it was a metaphorical story, cool. I don't know, like, what lesson you get out of your deity killing everybody on Earth through drowning, but hey, to each his own. So I asked her a series of questions, and it wasn't anything to be an asshole to my mother, because I'm not. It's just trying to get where she actually thinks, right? So I think I started off the questioning with, "Mom, do you believe that this man, this 900-year-old man, put two of every animal on this boat?" "Yes." "Okay. Did he have help?" "Yes, he had sons and, you know, his family help." "Okay, cool. Were there koalas on the boat?" "Yes." "Why are you asking me about koalas?" So I brought up, well, koalas can only eat eucalyptus, and eucalyptus only grows in Australia. So how did you get koalas from Australia to the Middle East? "Well, I don't know. It appeared in Israel or Egypt or wherever." "That doesn't seem right. So, okay. So how big did the boat have to be?" "Oh, well, whatever it says in the Bible." "Well, okay. If it's whatever it says in the Bible, well, where would you put predators like lions, and where would you put antelopes? Were they on the same boat, or like, where would you put them? Like, and then where was the food if the lions couldn't eat the gazelles? What did you feed them?" And I think, like, me just being honestly curious about how she thought, like, allowed her to kind of construct her beliefs. And I do that with everybody. Right. And it wasn't to be an ass. Like, I was genuinely asking questions on, all right, if this is true, I just want to see how somebody who believes it's true can construct how it occurred, right? How did we get the penguins from Antarctica to the Middle East? How did that occur? Like, what method occurred to make that happen? And then once they got off, how do we get the sloths to move from the Middle East back down to Australia?
Wow, that's a great, those are great questions. I feel like even that, like, I can imagine myself in a similar conversation, and I'm trying to think what context it was. But I feel like in those cases too, the people who you're asking those questions to will, like, kind of, it's not like they will project your negativity, or like, they'll, like, make it seem like you're trying to, right, because you're trying to fundamentally, like, unseat their beliefs and kind of unshake them. I think it can feel a little too not pointed. You know what I'm saying?
I think
they definitely can feel like they're on the spot.
I think what you're referring to, Miles, is kind of like this. Hey, they're coming to me with these questions with a goal in mind, a negative goal in mind. Like, they have an agenda that they want to come across. And one of the things in how to have impossible conversations is just genuinely, like, talk to somebody with curiosity. Like, in that conversation, I truly didn't have an agenda. I really just wanted to know how, if you believe this is true, how did this occur? Because I want understanding. I think that's how you should be with all conversations, right? Like, if you have a diametrically opposed viewpoint with somebody, let's be respectful to your conversation partner, develop the rapport, and then just truly, honestly, like, be open to discussing how they came to the beliefs and why they came to those beliefs. I think more importantly, how it came to those beliefs, because, to be honest, I don't think until I asked my mom all those questions, I don't think mm-hmm. she ever in her life really sat down and thought about how she came to that belief. Mm-hmm. I think there was a confluence of societal and cultural factors that created a Black woman in the South growing up in the 60s, 70s, and coming to prominence in the 80s. Like, obviously, she was probably going to be Christian. Like, that's, you grew up in Atlanta, you're probably going to be Christian. Like, that's right. Probably how she came to it. But I don't think, like, many people actually sit down and, like, honestly come to believe that their religious belief or their political belief are true because they went through a series of discussions with themselves, like, all right, why do I think this way? How do I come to this conclusion? And until you have those conversations with people, I don't think many of us have that.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of our episode with Travis. If you love our vibe, love what we're talking about, go ahead and click over to part two of this conversation. And if you're enjoying the show, go ahead and leave a rating and review on Apple Music. Thank you again.